Welcome to Hard Talk with me, Zainab Badawi. Can we afford the world's super rich? And what have they ever done for us? My guest today is a leading social thinker here in Britain, Professor Danny Dorling of Oxford University. He argues for a slow revolution against the top 1%, whom he claims are impoverishing the rest of us. If 99% of us are becoming more equal, does it really matter if a tiny minority are getting richer? Professor Danny Dorling, welcome to Hard Talk.
Hello.
You say that the world can't afford the super rich. Yeah. How do you define the global super rich?
The global super rich are probably the 1% of people in the rich countries of the world who have the most. You're talking about people earning a year at least $200,000. But of course, within that group, there is huge inequality. The top 1% of people in the world have more inequality among them than the other 99% of us.
But do you put them all in the same category? So, for example, you have talked about how 2% of family doctors in the UK, general practitioners, GP, yeah, earn about £200,000. Yes. That's about, I don't know, $300,000. Yeah. But they are often good public servants. So these people at the bottom of that 1%, they are public servants.
They're at the bottom.
Yeah, they're at the bottom. But, I mean, are they undeserving? Do you criticise them?
No, the vast majority of doctors in Britain are not in the best off 1%. It is only a tiny proportion, 2%, who are. And often they're in that because they're also running private companies at the same time. Almost all doctors, almost all head teachers, almost all politicians are not in the 1%. The 1% is a group which is dominated by financiers and people who are inheriting money. It's a group which is splitting away from the rest. And it's a group which at the bottom of it includes people on $200,000, $300,000, $400,000.
You're not so worried about them? You don't have them in your
I'm worried about this 1% zooming up, becoming richer and richer, taking more and more. And at the very top of this 1% are the very richest people on the planet. Oxfam earlier this year said 85 of them have the same wealth as the bottom half of humanity. Forbes magazine then corrected that and said actually it's 67. And then Forbes magazine corrected themselves and said it's 66. So at the top of the 1%, you have a tiny group who are zooming into the stratosphere.
Are they all undeserving? Because some of them are super rich because they've made great contributions to society through their innovations, through technology. The late Steve Jobs, for instance, fabulously wealthy, but revered by a lot of people because he transformed lives with his products.
A lot of these people are revered, and we have a culture which reveres celebrities and people at the top. But Steve didn't actually go and do the innovation himself. He was in charge of that company.
But all right, I use him as an example. Are there some people who, because they are so exceptional and have brought something unique to society, that they are in some ways deserving of the kind of remuneration they get?
I'm very happy with having an income distribution and some people paid much more than others. Say 10 times more than others. It's when you get to 50 or 100 times more than others that you have a problem. And there's a question about what you do with this money. Why do you need this much? In the UK, the best off 1% are taking 15% of all our income. That's a far higher proportion than anywhere else in Europe.
But they pay 30% of income tax.
Oh yes, well they have to, because who else will you get the income tax from?
But I'm saying that they are contributing to society if that 1% are paying 30% of income tax.
In a normal European country, more people pay income tax, it's more evenly spread, tax is not seen as a burden on those at the top. You all contribute and none of you take too much. That's a more normal situation. We've got this absurd situation in the UK where a third of all our tax is being paid by just 1% of people because they're paying themselves so much and because people on average and in the bottom half simply don't earn enough money.
But that's good. They're contributing. They are contributing through their wealth to the public kitty, aren't they?
It's far better not to have people very high paid and then have to tax them a lot. It's better to have more people paid a larger amount so they can actually live on their earnings, so they're not relying on benefits.
Why does it matter if there is this small number of very rich people. You talk about the financiers, the bankers. They're the ones who you're specifically talking
about. Because they cost so much. 15% of all UK income is an enormous sum of money. And it has effects on society. It changes what's seen as normal, and it actually ends up with less money for everybody else. So, for instance, we now pay more in our salaries and wages than we've ever done before, but we don't have enough to employ hundreds of thousands of young people.
But there's a recognition now, isn't there, of what you say? Yeah. I mean, bankers and bankers' pay has hardly been off the front of the newspapers in the UK and so many other parts of the world. Even the bankers themselves are saying our pay has been too high. Sir Philip Hampton, chairman of Royal Bank of Scotland, pay has been high for too long, particularly in the banks, particularly in the investment banks. That needs to be corrected.
It's beginning to turn. It's beginning to happen, but we still have in the UK well over 2,000 bankers earning over €1 million a year. The next highest number in the whole of Europe is Germany, where it's 197. If you take all the top bankers of the rest of Europe, they have less people paid that much than just those in London. Or if you take one bank, take Barclays. Barclays is paying 300 members of staff over £1 million a year. That is more than people have paid that amount in the whole of Japan, in every business in Japan.
But the point is that there are steps being taken, and there is legislation that's come through the European Parliament that's saying no bonuses, a cap on bonuses, for instance.
Europe is trying to do that, and our government is resisting it.
That is true. That's going through the courts at the moment. But just as a general kind of point of view, not just with the UK, bankers' pay and people being paid excessively, there is a recognition that that is not right.
Absolutely.
Is that right?
Absolutely. You have a beginning of a change. 10 years ago, we saw images of bankers quaffing champagne, paying $10,000 for a bottle. That kind of thing is no longer celebrated anymore. Greed is no longer seen as good. We've had all kinds of changes in society in all kinds of levels. Pay at the top has come down in various industries. But it's just the beginning of a change. There is a lot of resistance against this. And if you look at the income of the top 1% in the UK, HMRC said that last year
the tax man in the UK,
who knows more about incomes than anybody else, said that last year the 1% took a big hike in pay and were taking more again.
You're focusing a lot on the UK, but that is because the UK and the US have a disproportionate number of financiers, bankers and bosses, and also London in particular is the number one destination for a lot of the world's global rich. There are about 1,000 Russian millionaires living in the UK, according to the Sunday Times.
The UK is sucking in members of the super rich, but this is not the reason for the 1% having so much. Those are a small proportion of the 1%. In Switzerland, the 1% cost half as much as they cost in the UK, and the Swiss have a lot of bankers, but their bankers work for half as much, and they probably work even better. There haven't been as many problems in Switzerland when it comes to banking as there have been in London.
So the point in this little part of our of this interview is that British bankers still don't quite get it, and the authorities here don't, that they're still awarding excessive pay to the bankers, but the rest of the world is moving in the right direction from your point of view.
The rest of the world is, and several countries like the Netherlands and Switzerland are actually becoming more equal. We have a problem in Britain in particular, and it's partly a problem because of people from the rest of the world who have a lot of money moving in, making it very expensive to live here. So bankers actually ask for this money because they find it so hard to live, because the more people at the top who are paid more, the more expensive housing
in London. That's why I mentioned the Russian millionaires here. But now, you say in your new book, Inequality and the 1%, this. You say, we know that it is because of the huge cost of the top 1% that there is more poverty in the UK than in any more equitable rich nation. In a nutshell, what evidence do you have that the 1% are impoverishing the rest?
There's a very close correlation between the proportion that the 1% take in different countries and the poverty level, the proportion of households living on half average income. The evidence is that if you have people at the top taking more, there is less to give out for everybody else. There is less to give out in pay. It is harder to employ more young people. It is harder to pay them a decent amount if you're having to pay a few people very high salaries. So if you take a bank, and you look at the pay of cashiers and other people in the bank can't afford to pay people at the bottom more because it's paying people at the top so much.
But the picture's not so clear. If you look at Spain and Norway, the top 1% share of income has been falling in both Spain and Norway. But Spain is struggling economically. Yeah. Unemployment of 25%, double that for the under 24s, whereas Norway is doing quite well. So you can't just focus on that 1%.
Oh, yeah. The 1% doesn't explain everything. It's the strongest correlation of any kind of factor we can find for social harm, but of course it doesn't explain anything. And Norway is a small country which has oil. Spain is a large country which doesn't have oil. These kind of things matter as well. But you're thinking...
But where income, the share, a top 1% share of income has been falling in Spain, a recent survey says that 93% of people in Spain feel gloomy about their country and its prospects, whereas a recent Pew Research Centre survey this month about the UK says that there's been a surge in optimism amongst people in the UK about the economy. Some 43% of people here feel that the economic climate at home is good compared with just 15% last year. And that's the biggest leap in the 44 countries reviewed.
Yes, you tend to get, in more unequal countries like the USA, people tend to be more optimistic. And it's enough on these correlations. And it's partly one way of getting through life in the USA where you're so likely to do badly. The number of people at the bottom in the USA is larger supported than
any. But this is the UK
other.
I'm talking about, because you were talking about the UK.
In the UK, you have to have a get-up-and-go culture. You actually find in the more equal countries of the world, such as France and the Scandinavian countries, or think Finland or think Japan, people tend to be a little bit more dour. You don't get unbridled happiness when you get greater equality. That's not what it gives you. But you do get much less mental illness. You do get much less extreme poverty. You get much more efficient education systems. Your housing gets better sorted out. All kinds of things are improved. But people don't necessarily become happier just because they're more
equal.
But it's
not. I was just making this point about the top 1% share of income falling in Spain, and it's so bad in the UK, as you've said, and yet we've got these two very big extremes about how people in these countries feel about their economies. But does inequality between the 1% and the 99% matter so long as people are generally becoming better off? And Russ Roberts, Professor of Economics at Stanford University, says your well-being can grow even when your share of the pie falls if the pie is getting sufficiently larger.
It was much easier to defend growing inequality when people at the bottom were getting slightly better off. That hasn't happened for 20 years in the USA, and it now isn't happening in the UK. If you look at very bad effects to well-being, if you look at anxiety and depression and poor mental health, you find the highest rates of that in the most unequal countries. For instance, more Prozac is taken in the USA per head than almost anywhere else.
That's an antidepressant, right?
Yes. So there doesn't seem to be strong evidence to say that it doesn't matter what the rich get, as long as you're getting a few crumbs, you too can be happy. When it comes to severe problems about worrying about what's going to happen to your children, how are you going to get a job? Will you keep your job? Will you be able to pay the bills? Will you be able to keep your house? We're now having precarious housing in the USA and the UK in particular.
But I'm just looking at this correlation between the 1% and the 99%. Because if you say, and we accept your data or whatever, that gap is widening, as the Institute for Fiscal Studies in the UK says, that as that very richest small 1% is becoming richer, the rest of us are becoming more equal. It says, so if there is more equality within that 99%, does it matter if the super rich are on their yachts and in their mansions?
It does matter because it has a pervasive effect on the rest of society over what people at the top do.
If there's more equality amongst the 99%, does it matter?
Could we all be happy with a small aristocracy at the top as long as we were all more similar together? That's the kind of question I think you're putting.
Well, it is, yes. And what's your answer?
It's hard to find anywhere on the planet which does appear particularly happy, which arranges itself in that way. The nearest place you have is Singapore. Singapore is the most unequal of the rich nations by income inequality. It has that very small group who are very rich and a large group who are very poor. And part of that poverty is it has a very large number of guest workers who are working in service who are not allowed to have children. There are 100,000 maids in Singapore who are pregnancy tested every 3 months. Sure, and if they're pregnant, they have to leave.
But these are the guest workers and you know, the asylum seekers and the irregular migrants and so on. You can't use those to illustrate your point. OK, let me put it to you another way, which is what this professor of economics at George Mason University in Washington, Tyler Cohen, is saying. Although significant economic problems remain, we have been living in equalising times for the world, a change that has been largely for the good. That may not make for convincing sloganeering, but it's the truth. It's the truth. The world is becoming richer. Yeah. More and more people have been lifted out of poverty in the last 20 years.
You are getting a growing middle class in the world at around about the average Chinese income level, certainly. So more people are becoming average worldwide. You have extreme poverty in the world, of course, still, which is not improving that fast. But at the top are still zooming off. So that in the United States, and often these professors come from the US, Obama had to admit that under his watch, 95% of all income gains in the United States have gone to the 1%.
Perhaps are you too fixated on that 1% in order to try to improve the lives of the 99%? Professor Deirdre McCloskey, a celebrated economic historian, says, I'm concerned about the condition of the working class, not about how many yachts some oligarch has. It's not the expenditure on the high end that causes poverty on the low end. The real problem is poverty, and the solution to that is not going after the rich.
If you look at those countries where the working class, or say the bottom 40% of society, do best, they are countries like Japan, where the 1% take the least. This is a very, very clear correlation. The working class, people at the bottom, get treated worst when there are huge inequalities at the top. People don't view other people as like them. They can't. It's very hard to see other people as important of you, because if you're getting so much more than them, it has to be, well, you have to think, because you're special, you're different, you're worth much more than them. So these people are not worth as much.
But
and that alters
really?
How they're treated in the unequal countries. People at the bottom are treated much, much
because
worse.
Because of that 1%, I mean, surely we all know that those people who live in their mansions with the underground swimming pool and the private jets and the yachts and so on, I mean, that's just a tiny minority. And we don't think, oh, I'd like to be like them, or I am in this situation because he's got one yacht too many.
People's families don't mix. When you have the kind of inequalities that we now have in London, if you compare the best off 10th of people in London to worst off 10th, we've done it for children, the best off 10th of children in London are in families with 100 times the wealth of the poorest 10th. They don't mix. They don't go to the same schools. They don't socialise. They might mix when somebody comes and cleans their house, but that doesn't result in the kind of respect
you get in other
countries.
But it's what you do about it. It's what you do about it. And this is the point. Yeah. If you look at what the Indian government is doing, Narendra Modi, very pro-reform, pro-market, son of a Gujarati tea seller, so an example there of social mobility. And he's saying, yes, of course, I'm going to tackle those at the bottom most with poverty alleviation programmes. But I also want to look at that 380 million members of what he calls the neo-middle class, the aspirational class. And his finance minister, Arun Jaitley, says, we are calibrating India to match aspirations. There is an aspirational India. It has to be supported and strengthened. And so that's the point. Why not focus on strengthening the 99%
and their aspirations rather than
just going after the 1%?
Because the 1% is 1%. The 99% cannot all fit in the 1%. I've nothing against aspiration. It's great. Unless your aspiration is to have much, much more than other people. The whole point of these inequalities is that if you run a society where you tell people, if you work hard enough, if you try hard enough, if you get to the very top, you'll be okay. But if you just miss the very top, if you get to the bottom of the top 10%, you'll have an insecure pension, you'll have to worry about your old age, your health service might not be well provided. That is an unfair situation. You cannot all get in, or in fact, anywhere near the top 1%. A happy society is not one in which the 1% are done okay, and you're trying to tell everybody else that that's where they should aim for.
Are you opposed to capitalism and free market economies? Is that the crux of what you're saying, that you think it breeds this kind of huge gap between the 1% and the 99%?
We're in capitalism. We've got it whether we like it or not. We've had it for about 400 years. We're likely to get it carry on for another couple of centuries. But if you compare different capitalist countries, you find remarkable differences between them. In the Netherlands, the top 1% are taking less than 7%. you know, it's a very different country.
The Netherlands is a bit of an economic basket case and, you know, lost its AAA credit rating and so on.
We lost our credit, you know.
It's improving now, but I'm just saying that, yeah, it's just one factor, isn't it,
but
to take into account.
In the Netherlands, you get, I think it was the boss of Oil.Shell, I may be wrong, but certainly industry leaders in the Netherlands saying statements such as, if you paid me twice as much, I wouldn't work any harder. Hmm. And if you paid me half as much, it wouldn't actually damage me. You never hear that kind of statement in the UK, and certainly not in the USA.
You're putting up as an example, its economy has been contracting and it's got one of the worst performing economies in the EU. So I'm just saying that you may say it does well in some cases, but it's not obviously performing well in other
cases. But it doesn't have food banks. It doesn't have people going to get food from soup kitchens as the UK now has and as the USA has had for 20 years. Mm. If you look at, and the Netherlands is the average country for inequality in Europe. If you look at average European countries, you'll see that the lot of most people is much better. Okay. The average person, and they have 35-hour weeks.
People so what can do have you do about it then? You've said, for instance, that housing in the UK is a big issue, is the defining economic issue of our times. Yeah. And you say that you can't build enough housing to make up for the shortage. So one eye-catching suggestion you have is that you make it you give a financial disincentive for the elderly to stay in their family homes because they may be too big since the kids have moved out, so that people like newly arrived immigrants can be housed.
Or newly formed families. Just British families can't get themselves a house at the moment.
So is that really a policy? Make it difficult for grandma or grandpa to stay in their family home so that new families can move in? Is that really a policy that a politician could campaign on?
The first thing you have to accept is that you've got a problem and inequality is a problem. At the moment in the UK, we do not. Our major political parties do not accept it as that much of a problem. None of them has a target to try to reduce it. Mm-hmm. If you look at housing, our housing now is more unequally distributed than it was in 1911, which was the last peak. We have more empty bedrooms than ever before, something like 40 million empty bedrooms.
So something radical has to be done.
Not necessarily radical, but you could say we need to begin to share things out a little bit more equally, because no matter how fast you build, you cannot build as fast as you could redistribute.
Who's going to be responsible for implementing the kind of policies that you've been advocating? The politicians, because nobody trusts them.
Some politicians do advocate these kind of things. Admittedly, it's a marginal group of politicians in a country like the UK, but in a normal European country, these are mainstream ideas. It is for normal to ensure your population is well housed. And in Germany, for instance, for decades, they've tried to prevent house price inflation. So the kind of policies I would like are normal in more equal countries, but in the USA, they appear like madness, and in the UK, they're on the fringe.
So the policies are housing, we've discussed, higher taxation levels that we saw up until the 1970s in the UK, in the 90s at the top end.
I would begin to put the very high rate of tax up and a rate higher above it. The reason is not to raise money. The top tax rate doesn't raise money. What it does is when you've got a young banker earning £4 million a year and they ask for £6 million because they hear another young banker's got £6 million, they're likely to be deterred from doing that if they know they're not going to get most of that money. It's a deterrent to greed is top rate tax of 150,000 to 200,000.
Okay, briefly, you've talked about a slow revolution in your new book. There are two points raised, you say, two views. One, that salvation is upon us. It's just we've not noticed yet that getting rich quick has lost its luster. And the other point of view says the end is nigh because of greed and all will not end peacefully. Which is it?
I would hope it would be more of a recognition so that it can end more peacefully than otherwise. The kind of lack of peace that I'm talking about, if we don't address this, is that the London housing market keeps on rising and then crashes.
But a bigger picture is a final point. Just housing.
The bigger picture is you see growing unrest around the world as young people, and almost all young people are badly affected by this, become angrier and angrier because unless they're born into a rich family, they work out they cannot on their own, through their own merit, get to have just a decent standard of living. If we don't do something about it, you're looking at masses of very well-educated university graduates around the world who begin to figure that this is not in their interests. You have to change societies so that people can have a safe and decent life for their families, even if they can't get into the 1%.
How quickly, briefly, is the slow revolution going to see a result? Very quickly.
It's 10 or 20 years. It's a slow revolution. The last time it happened in the 1920s and 1930s, people didn't realise it was happening, but it was.
Professor Danny Dorning, thank you very much indeed for coming on Hard Talk.
Thank you.
Thank you.